1,000 push-ups on one hand on broken glass. Whew, if only my students could see me. Anyway. So Wednesday, Hylia, 3 p.m., we've had 5 in-class test terms. One was Polis, then Archon, then Archy, then Oligarchy, and finally Aristocracy. So I will not be keeping track of them, but I'll just say this one time and maybe every now and then, you need to be keeping track of them, either underlining them or highlighting them or something of that sort, because there's going to be a lot of them. Now, on with today's lecture. We spoke last time. We covered about 10,000 years of history. And we finished up with the Greeks. We said that Athens was the first place to come up with a non-monarchical government. That was the aristoi. That's where we got aristocracy. And that was hereditary power. Then they got into debt slavery. Something needed to be done. A man named Solon reformed everything. That's great. That opened the door for it to become something different. A timocracy. What Aristotle defined as a government of the wealthy and talented. And I mentioned to you that that may not seem like much of a difference, inherited wealth versus wealth that you actually earned, but it's a big, big difference in terms of competence, in terms of everything. By the way, Aristotle and pretty much everybody, they said, okay, government of the wealthy and talented. Through most of history, people just assumed if you were one, you would have the other. You see, that's the difference between now we have a much more rational way of looking at things. Now we understand a wealthy person might have no talent or brains whatsoever. And a talented, smart person might not be rich. Back then, they saw it very differently. They thought those two went together. And here it goes to a larger sense, even now with this coronavirus and everything. Let's say it was a normal kind of sickness, a cold, or something more serious, a flu. Okay, what is the full name of a flu? Many of you know influenza, but what is the full name of the flu? It is influenza distraza. And what that means is under the influence of the stars. People thought, oh, if you're not feeling well, if you're throwing up, if you're feeling weak, anything like that, it must be because your stars are out of alignment. It must be astrology. That's the reason. Not only sickness, but let's say a hurricane hit, or let's say it was an earthquake, or let's say it was a flood or anything like that. What would we call that? What would we'd call it a disaster. And what two parts is that word made from? Dis means bad. Aster means pertaining to the stars. Astronomy, astronaut, asteroid. So a disaster, again, they thought it was bad stars. Your stars are out of alignment. Now, if you... there were times when actually they would see these mystical things as good. Most of these creatures, supernatural creatures, were evil and devious and gremlins and whatnot, making things go wrong. But every now and then there was a spirit that you really wished you could find that would make your wishes come true. A genie. Now, people believed in ancient times if you were a really good guitar player or sculptor. I mean, they didn't have guitar in ancient times, but a painter or a sculptor or a singer or whatever it is. The reason you're able to do that, it must be because you were a possessor of a genie that was forever whispering good ideas into your ear. And a possessor of a genie, the word for that is genios. That's where the word genius comes from. And you see, it's in everything. It's in things we don't even realize. Let's say you're taking an exam. You don't know what the answer is. Because back in the day, unfortunately, if you had some disfigurement, if you had some physical deformity, people would think you were touched by the devil. That's what it is. You were touched by the devil, and that's why this is what your body looks like. But they also believed you had to have insight into the future, that you could tell the future. And back to my example, if you're taking an exam, you don't know what the answer is, but you have a feeling. You have a guess. You have what's called a hunch. It's from that old term, hunchback. Terrible. But you see, this is how most of history has seen the world, in what's called a pre-modern view. And unfortunately, that happens a lot even today. Many people who don't have the opportunity or the discipline or whatever it is to become educated, they see things in this way. I mean, all of us, I think, see it this way to a certain extent. That's why this education is so important, and specifically the education that comes from history. So, government of the wealthy and talented. But those people, the business class, the entrepreneurs, they got into power, and they really opened the door for demoskratia, which we talked about. And that was not like our democracy. Demos means people, kratia means rule or government. Democracy, theirs was a pure democracy where everybody who could vote voted on every issue. We're going to move past that now to Rome, but just food for thought. You know, it's various reasons why we didn't do that when our country was founded, and I'll explain that. But we can certainly do it now. We have the ability to vote on every single issue. We vote on American Idol and stuff. Why can't we vote on every issue, pass or fail? Maybe we'll get into that. But I brought up Rome. I brought up that they had to get really, really good at fighting. But what is the origin of Rome? Some of you may know, or something may know something about the origin. The twin brothers, Romulus and Remus, when they were born, there was a prophecy that they would grow up and kill the king. So the king ordered his soldiers to take the babies and drown them in the river. The soldiers left the babies there at the river, but didn't actually drown them. Just let the tide come in and then drown them. The soldiers left. Well, the myth is that they were suckled by a she-wolf. They were saved and suckled by a she-wolf. And again, this is the idea of Rome, raised by strong, ferocious, literally a wolf, literally raised by wolves. Now, even the Romans themselves didn't really believe this. They thought it was a variation on it. An innkeeper's wife, who was a prostitute who went by the name Wolf, took them in and suckled them. But either way, they grew to manhood, came back, and indeed they did overthrow and kill the king. Then they go off to settle their own settlements, to create their own towns. Now, Romulus is still building his settlement, his walls. Remus completes his early. Remus goes over to Romulus's area, jumps over his unfinished walls, and says, "You'll have to do better than that, brother." Romulus kills his twin brother instantly, saying, "Such is the fate of all who trespass my boundaries." That's another thing. Rome, you see, myths will tell you a lot about a people, about a culture. They say if you want the facts, read nonfiction. If you want the truth, read fiction. They also say art is the lie that tells the truth. But again, the myths that people believe about themselves tell you a lot. And here it was, Rome, born in blood. Even his own twin brother, killed at the first sign of defiance. So, this is the myth, and we really don't know the true origin of Rome because the Romans didn't know it. Something happened to them early on. They got invaded. Okay, as I told you last lecture, the Romans had really good, excellent farmland, and when you have something good, everybody wants to take it. So that's why the Romans got so good at fighting. So early on in their history, this tribe of Gauls is modern, Gaul, G-A-U-L, is where modern France was, is today. So this tribe of Gauls invaded the Romans. They have a plan for it, just like I mentioned hurricanes. When there's a hurricane coming, we all get into our houses or homes, put up shutters, everything like that, and wait for the hurricane to pass. The Romans and pretty much all the ancient people would do something similar. Okay, the Gauls came in, like invaders usually do. The Romans retreated, took all their valuables, got high in the hills, fortified themselves, and waited for the Gauls to leave. But this situation was unusual. This time, the invaders didn't leave. They stayed and stayed and stayed. And finally, Rome had to pay them 1,000 pounds in gold before they would leave, which is humiliating enough. This is beyond humiliating and very expensive. But okay, they start bringing out their gold, rings, necklaces, coins, everything like that, and it's all being weighed out and weighed out over and over again. Now, the Romans notice that the scales the Gauls are using are unfair. They tell the Gauls, look, you're making us pay too much. The Gaul chieftain takes off his huge heavy broadsword, unsheathes it, tosses it onto the pile of weights that counterbalance the gold. And it's so heavy, it sends the gold coins and everything flying into the air. And the Gaul chieftain laughs and says, Vae victis. Woe, which means woe to the vanquished. Vae victis. Basically, so what? What are you going to do about it? And in fact, the Romans had to pay not only the 1,000 pounds in gold on the unfair scale, but they also had to pay the weight of the broadsword. Now, the Romans never forgot this, and centuries later they would enter Gaul and teach them a lesson they would never forget. But either way, we don't know the founding of Rome because the Romans didn't know it, because when the Gauls invaded, one of the things they did is they burned a lot of the records and everything like that. They looted and pillaged, and the records of Rome's founding were destroyed. So, let's have three test terms. Here is the first test term of today. Direct democracy. Direct democracy. That is the test term, direct democracy. And for that you need to write AKA, which stands for also known as. So write AKA, quote, pure democracy, close quote, period. The people vote on every issue, comma. The people vote on every issue, comma. Without going through representatives and legislatures, period. In the U.S., comma, we have this in limited form through ballot initiatives, B as in boy, A-L-L-O-T, ballot initiatives, comma, referendums, comma, and recall of elected officials, period. Okay. Now, for that one, I'll just say a few words. direct democracy, pure democracy, that's what the Athenians had, basically. Everybody voted on every issue, and that's fine. Now here, we do have that in the United States to a certain extent through these three things I mentioned. Ballot initiatives. What's that? If the people want, if they really want something, they can sign a petition, a big petition, in many places in the country and force an issue to be put up for vote. So even if the politicians don't want it to come to vote, even if they are dead set against it, the people can force them to put this up for a vote. Referendums. Referendum is kind of a variation on that. It's where the politicians come up with a proposal and then the people get to vote yes or no whether it becomes a law. They did this with legalizing medical marijuana. Now, the first time it failed because it got 58% of people, if I recall, voted for it, but it needed to pass by 60%. So it failed the first time, then they put it up again, and the next time it passed. That would be an example of a referendum. And then recall of elected officials. What's that? That's happened a number of times in America. If you know, most of you know who Arnold Schwarzenegger is, he also became governor of California. The reason he was able to do that is people were so upset, people in California were so upset with their own governor that they actually said, we don't even want him to finish out his term. We're going to recall him now. They signed a petition, they had a vote, they kicked him out. Here in Miami, the mayor of Miami, he did a few things to make himself really unpopular, mainly this Marlins Stadium, and people said, that's it. We want him out. We did not let the mayor finish his term. We kicked him out ahead of time. So in some ways, we do have direct democracy or pure democracy here in America. But what we really have is this next test term, second test term of today, indirect democracy. Indirect democracy, democracy. For that you need to write, the people vote for representatives, comma. The people vote for representatives, comma. Who then vote for every issue. Open parentheses. In the best interest of the people, comma. In the best interest of the people, comma. But not necessarily as desired by the people. Close parentheses, period. Indirect democracy, the people vote for representatives, comma, who then vote for every issue. Open parentheses, in the best interest of the people, comma, but not necessarily as desired by the people. Close parentheses, period. Now, this is what we have here. We are still a government of the people, but it's indirect. We vote on these politicians, and then the politicians vote on every issue. And here, this is an important distinction. People say, oh, the politicians aren't doing what we say. Once we vote them in the office, they just do whatever they want. They're not responsive. Well, the thing is, this is the way the system is meant to work. We get to choose who the best people are, the wisest, the people who are most honest, the people of best character. And then they get to decide what they think is best. Now, third test term before we really get into the lecture. Res publica. R-E-S space publica. P-U-B-L-I-C-A. So it's two words. Res, R-E-S. Publica, P-U-B-L-I-C-A. That is the test term. For that, you need to write.
Latin for, quote, Latin for, quote, this public thing, close quote. Latin for, quote, this public thing, close quote, period. Then write, government of the people. Government of the people. Open parentheses, anglicized, A-N-G-E-L-I-C-I-Z-E-D. I hope I spell that right. Anglicized to, quote, what is it anglicized to? Quote, republic. Close quote, close parentheses, period. So res publica is a test term, and what you need to know is Latin for, quote, this public thing, close quote, period. Government of the people, open parentheses, anglicized to, quote, republic, close quote, close parentheses, period. Now, what does this mean? What's going on here? Essentially, definitely this republic is an indirect democracy, but remember, these terms, democracy, timocracy, aristocracy, that's Greek. And now we are in the Roman area, they're speaking Latin. So it's a different language, and that's why we have this different term, res publica. It means this public thing as opposed to a private thing. The ruler doesn't own the country, doesn't own the people. It belongs to the public. And anglicized, what on earth does that mean? Well, what happens is, and I'm jumping a little bit ahead in this lecture, Rome, like any civilization, like any person, like everybody, everything, every country, it moves in cycles. It goes up, but eventually it has its downfall. Rome will eventually have very serious problems, very serious problems. And even though it's conquered a huge, vast area, huge, huge area, including Britain, what happens is Rome has too many enemies coming at them from too many different sides. And the emperor wrote a letter. The emperor of Rome wrote a letter to the people of Britain. Look, we're in trouble. We need to recall the legions. The legions are the Roman military formations. We'll try and send them back if we can, but don't count on it. This is how serious the problem had gotten with Rome. They cannot even defend their own territories anymore. They have to cut Britain loose and say, look, you're on your own. That's it. Imagine the situation got so bad here in America that the president had to write a letter to Alaska and Hawaii, we're sorry, we cannot defend you. We're taking back all our troops. You're on your own. But that's what happened with Rome. However, one of the ways that Romans would reward their soldiers is by giving them land after they did their duty. Now, the land in the Roman area and Italy and everything had been taken up already, and so they were giving them land in Britain. Now, this meant that most of these Romans in Britain were ex-soldiers, and they knew how to fight. They were willing to fight. They were ready to fight, and they did. They got together, and the thing is, a brilliant leader. We're still not sure if he existed, but Artoris. He rallied the people, unified them, led them properly, led them really well, and they put the hurt on the barbarians so badly. It was, I think, 70 years before they came back to try again. And this was so important to the people of Britain, this is the legend of King Arthur and his Knights of the Round Table. King Arthur. So actually, they held on a very, very long time in Britain. But eventually, the barbarians came there in large numbers, three groups. The Angles, the Saxons, and the Jutes. Now, the junior part, you may have heard of Anglo-Saxons and Anglo-Saxon culture and everything like that. This is where it comes from. And again, all these barbarian tribes, I mentioned it very briefly early in the semester, but these barbarian tribes that take down Rome are all German. These are the savage Germans who are doing this. And we'll speak a little bit more about that later. So what happens is the Angles, the Saxons, and the Jutes invade, and the junior partners, which are the Angles, they actually give their name to the land, Angle Land, Land of the Angles, which we pronounce England. They gave their name to the language, Angle-ish, which we pronounce English. So, that's what it was, and that's where this word anglicized comes from. It means how we would say it in English, how we would write it, how we would, that's what anglicize means. So, those are the three test terms. Now, maybe I should give you these next two now just to save a little bit of time, and then we'll have a long, long, lengthy lecture. I will do that. This is the fourth test term. Patrician. P as in Paul, A-T-R-I-C-I-A-N as in Nancy, P-A-T-R-I-C-I-A-N as in Nancy. For that you need to write, in Rome, comma, it meant, quote, well-fathered. Close quote. Period. Then write the privileged, comma, upper class of wealthy landowners. The privileged, comma, upper class of wealthy landowners. So in Rome, comma, it meant, quote, well-fathered. Close quote. Period. Then continue writing, the privileged, comma, upper class of wealthy landowners, period. Now, what's going on here is, if you remember last lecture, we talked a little bit about the history of last names. Well, the names all mean something. All of your names mean something. And here, if you know anybody named Patricia or Patrick, anything like that, it means well-fathered. That's it. And it's actually not an Irish name, as people say, oh, St. Patrick's Day and this and that. It goes all the way back to the Latin in Rome. Patrician, patrician. Now, these people are also known as blue bloods. I don't know if you've heard these terms before, but they're important terms to know. Blue bloods are like aristocratic, or their upper class, the really well-established, highly respected, the good families. That's what it is. Even today, you hear that term, proud patrician families, or whatever it is. There's a lot we could say about this, but I will not spend too much time. I will say about this term, blue blood. If anyone has heard that, why on earth would you call them blue bloods? Blood is not blue. You know, it's depending on what part of the body it's in, whether they're it's been oxygenated or not, it's either red or dark red. However, what's going on is in the veins it looks blue. But to be able to see it, your skin has to be very fair, has to be very light-skinned. And that's one of the reasons why racism came about, because what is it that darkens your skin? What causes your skin to get darker? Being out in the sun doing manual labor. And so the less dark your skin was, the less manual labor you had to do, the wealthier you must be, the more powerful you must be, and that's why people wanted their skin as light as possible. And it's also in different cultures. Same thing. You would think, you know, that it should be, oh, the hard-working people should be more esteemed, more valued. But it really isn't. It's typical in a lot of places. In China, the longer your fingernails were, the more prestigious it was. Longer your fingernails were, the more prestigious it was. And indeed, as your fingernails get longer, they become all curled up and nasty looking and terrible. And it really, the ideal in China was for your fingernails to be so long you couldn't even lift a teacup. Why on earth would that be respected and admired and associated with wealth? Well, I think you can figure that one out. You'd be so wealthy, you pay someone to lift that teacup up to your mouth every time you want to sip. That's what it is, and we associate these types of things. There's a reason for everything. By the way, there's a reason why blood is red. What is that reason? Why is blood red? It's because it has iron in it and it's rusting. That's why Mars is red, because it's rusting. And in fact, if our blood was based on copper instead of iron, our blood would be green. You know, like the Statue of Liberty. I may say a few words about it later in the semester, because these are important to American history. Statue of Liberty, things like that, Liberty Bell. Statue of Liberty, some of you may know, it was entirely copper-colored when it was given to us, because it was made of copper. That's why. But it got this green patina, as it was expected to, and that's why it looks green now. Anyway. Now, the next test term. Plebeian. P as in Paul. L-E. B as in boy. E-I-A-N as in Nancy. P-L-E-B-E-I-A-N. Plebeian. Now this one's a little bit much, but just write it up. This is what you need to know about it. From, quote, Plierre, P-L-E-R-E, close quote. Open parentheses, quote, to fill up, close quote, close parentheses, comma. Today a great insult, comma. But back then, comma, today a great insult, comma, but back then, comma, meant common farmer, comma, member of the general citizenry, period. Originally excluded from almost all public offices. Originally excluded from almost all public offices, period. So once again, the test term is plebeian. For that, you need to write from, quote, Plierre, close quote. Open parentheses, quote, to fill up, close quote, close parentheses, comma. Today, a great insult, comma, but back then, comma, meant common farmer, comma, member of the general citizenry, period. Originally excluded from almost all public offices. Originally excluded from almost all public offices. Now, what does this mean? It's important to understand that originally it was not an insult. Today, if somebody calls you plebeian or a plebeian, that's a big insult. But it's, again, you know how well I speak Spanish, but I do know one or two Spanish words, a few of them, and I think this would be comparable to chonga, chonga, anyway, and maybe comparable to chancleta fight, anyway, so don't let anybody call you a plebeian today, but originally, it's just a regular farmer. However, this is how the Romans saw these people. So the vast majority of people are the plebeians, regular people. That name comes from plier, which is the Latin word for to fill up. So filler, It's like you get a package in the mail. The styrofoam and everything that it's packed in, which you throw out, which is pointless, which is useless. That's how they saw the common people. Just filler for the actual good people, which are the patricians, who made up maybe 4% of all Romans. The aforementioned blue bloods. Now, what's going on here? I mentioned briefly, last lecture, I mentioned that the Romans did not want to share power. They did not want to give the regular people power, but they needed someone to do the fighting for them. Who is going to do the fighting? Well, the common plebeians. And they did fight for a while, but very soon they said, no, we don't get a say in government. Why should we? You want to have all the decision-making power. You defend yourselves. And on multiple occasions when an invader was coming, this happened not just once, but multiple times when Rome was had attackers approaching, the plebeians, which is the majority of Roman people, all got together and literally walked out of the city. They said, we're not doing this. We're leaving. And so the patricians, the people in power, had to give more and more and more power to the commoners. And that's how and why Rome became fairly egalitarian and things like that. If you see in Vietnam, you guys have all heard of the Vietnam War. And most of you have heard of Muhammad Ali. Muhammad Ali, super famous popular boxer, Vietnam War comes around, he refuses to serve. He refuses to serve in Vietnam. And this caused a lot of controversy. A lot of controversy. People questioned him. The press kept asking him, why aren't you serving your country? Why aren't you fighting these Viet Cong who are our enemy? And Muhammad Ali, finally, he got so fed up, he shouted at one of the reporters, because no Viet Cong ever called me N-word. N-I-G-G-E-R. And that's what, that got him into a lot of trouble, a lot of controversy and everything like that. But the Vietnam War, all these issues that happened thousands of years ago, other side of the world, whatever it is, they're just as relevant today. They'll be just as relevant 500 years from now. They'll be just as relevant 10,000 years from now. Other than the Vietnam War, the young people were protesting, old enough to fight, old enough to vote. Why, when they were young enough, 18 or whatever it is, and at the time they weren't allowed to vote, why are they able to be sent to war? Anyway, so this is what happens with the Romans, and the society becomes more and more balanced, more and more egalitarian. It's not a direct democracy, it is an indirect democracy. And this republic, this res publica, this is the basis of our country. As I mentioned, our government is a copy. Now, mind you, the government we have now in America was not our original government. It was a different one, but it failed miserably. And then the founding fathers got together and said, we need something that works. No more trying to create something inventive or whatever it is. And they looked back through history and they said, the Roman Republic, that worked. So, what is this Roman? Let's get into it. Let's examine what are its components, what is the principle by which it worked, everything like that. Now, we can see they had, this is not a test term, but they had a Senate. Guess which part of our government is modeled after the Roman Senate? The Senate. And by the way, the word Senate comes from the word senex, which means old men. So again, there you can see who they think should be in power, who society thinks should be ruling and making all the decisions. Now, the Senate originally was entirely patrician. Plebeians could not be a part of it, but they eventually were allowed to be a part of this super prestigious body. There was another part of it called the Plebeian Assembly, and this is a test term. P as in Paul. L-E-B-E-I-A-N. That was just a term you had before, but this term is Plebeian Assembly. A-S-S-E-M-B-L-Y. So one term was plebeian, this term is plebeian assembly. For that you need to write, looked after the interests of the average Romans. Looked after the interests of the average Romans. Period. It was presided over by 10 tribunes. T, a capital T, R I B as in boy, U N E S. Period. Okay, looked after the interests of the average Romans, period. It was presided over by 10 tribunes. Now, what's this? The Romans, as I've said before, are not a very creative group. They want to create a group of old men where they call them a bunch of old men, which is Senex. They want to create an assembly of plebeians. What do they call it? A plebeian assembly. That's it. Now, the thing is, even when the plebeians got their own assembly, they kept getting pushed around and intimidated by these wealthy, powerful patricians. And so, they created these people, the tribunes, to watch over it, to watch out, and to make sure no one is pushing them around. All the people of Rome had to swear an oath to kill anyone who harmed the tribune. This made it more even. Okay, the patricians have wealth and power, but now these tribunes have everyone in Rome ready to defend them, ready to kill to protect them. So this is checks and balances. We're starting to see these checks and balances, if that term sounds familiar to any of you. Checks and balances. Now, as a side note, a lot of newspapers are called the Tribune, the Chicago Tribune, the Podunk Tribune, whatever it is, because the tribunes in ancient Rome, they presided over the institution that looked after the people. They looked after the people, and these newspapers see themselves as looking after the people. So, next test term, we have consulate. C-O-N, as in Nancy, S-U-L-A-T-E. C-O-N-S-U-L-A-T-E. Consulate is the test term. For that, you need to write, Office of Roman Chief Executives. Period. Elected to office for 1 year. Period. So consulate, but that you need to write, Office of Roman Chief Executives, elected to office for 1 year. Period. That is what our president is based on. So you have our Senate is based on the Roman Senate. Our House of Representatives is based on the Plebeian Assembly. Now we'll get into that. Our presidency is based on the consulate. Okay, there you go. Now, what is this consulate upon which our presidency is based? What does this have to do with anything? Well, the Romans have these leaders. They are extremely, extremely powerful. But the Romans understand, so they've invested a lot of power in these consuls. No doubt about that. By any measure, they're extremely powerful. But the Romans understood about power, and in a larger sense, they understood about emotion. There was an outstanding history professor here many years ago, Dr. Charles Cox, and he explained that you will never read this in a book, you will never hear this in a lecture, but the Romans are the most emotional people in the history of the world. And in fact, I agree, he was absolutely right. Even more than the French, even more than anyone, the Romans are super emotional, and you see it. You don't usually see it. You think of Rome, oh, discipline, control, everything like that. And that is true, but you see it when they lose control, when they get angry, something like that. That's when you really see, oh, you know, this is what they're really like. And because the Romans understood this about emotion, they understood it would destroy them if they didn't control it. They elevated discipline almost to the level of a religion. And that translated into a genius for order and government. And that's how they got such an effective form of government, this res publica. And we copied that, and it's not a coincidence that we've done so well. It's not a fluke that America has been so successful in such a short amount of time. We had a really, really good government. Now, the Romans understood you need this control over the emotion. I would compare it to an alcoholic or a drug addict. They just have to cut it out completely. They have to have absolute control over it. The Romans saw it kind of the same way. Tight, absolute control. Don't let your emotions get out of hand. And one of those emotions is when it comes to power. People become power mad. Power can be addictive. And there's this famous saying, power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Maybe you guys have known people who became power mad. They went to their heads. They thought they could do everything and anything, and everybody's there to serve them. Well, the Romans didn't want this. Now here with the consulate, yes, it was a very powerful position, but one of the ways that they check these consuls is they are only in power for 1 year. 1 year and that's it. Is the person allowed to run again? They are allowed to run again after 10 years have passed. That way everything has gotten out of their system. They haven't had time to set up entrenched alliances or anything like that. A good long time has passed in between their term serving. Now, there are other checks and balances. One of those checks and balances is, in fact, this is probably the biggest one. Do you notice that there were 10 tribunes? It's an even number. For the consulate, there's not one chief executive at a time, but two. And both of them have to agree for a decision to go forward. If they both don't agree, if one of them says veto, V-E-T-O, V as in Victor, E-T-O. That is not a test term, but it's a term many of you may have heard in government. The president vetoes bills, everything like that. Veto is Latin for I forbid. I forbid. It's another thing we copied from the Romans. And this way, both consuls have to agree on a major decision, on any decision really, for it to go forward. This is, it reminds me of, for example, launching a nuclear missile. Really, it seems that one person alone cannot launch the nuclear missile. Even if they get the order, even if it's legitimate, you need two people turning a key simultaneously, and the places are too far apart for one individual person to turn both keys. That way, let's say a person goes crazy. Their child died, or they had a chemical imbalance in their brain or something like that. they still won't be able to launch the nuclear missiles. If, in fact, speaking of going crazy, pilots flying a plane, you have a pilot and you have a co-pilot. When one of them might go crazy, one of them might have a heart attack, anything like that. If you have one, that's basically close to none. Whereas if you have two, you have a backup. Now, unfortunately, sometimes there's a problem. A couple of years back, there was this this plane where one of the pilot went to the bathroom, okay? Came back, door was locked. He's banging on the door, hey, let me in. Co-pilot's not letting him in. Now, time is going by, and the pilot sees something is wrong. This is definitely something wrong. The altitude is too low. What's going on? The pilot is now trying to break down the door and get into the cockpit. But he can't because this is after September 11th where the planes were hijacked and everything. And so we armored up the doors so they couldn't be broken down, which is another principle of history I keep bringing up. Every advantage can turn into a disadvantage and vice versa. So here now, because we had armored up the doors and they couldn't be broken down, now this pilot wasn't able to get back in. And what happened is the co-pilot had gone crazy. After the fact, we looked at things, we looked at his record, we went through his stuff, everything like that. He crashed the plane into the mountain and killed everybody. But after the fact, you know, they obviously searched through this co-pilot's stuff and everything, and they found out he was imagining demons or this and that. He was crazy. He had a mental breakdown, something like that. So, in engineering, by the way, I don't think there definitely aren't many engineering majors in the class, but there is a saying in engineering, two is one, one is none. Two is one, one is none. What that means is they plan for things to go wrong. They expect that something is going to break down, and that's why they have two, and they count that as one. So they'll assume if you have one gauge or something like that, one Geiger counter, eventually it will break. It's not a question of if. Eventually it's going to break. So if you don't have a second one, you have none. Two is one, meaning one is going to break and then you'll have one. One is none, meaning that when that one breaks, you'll have none. So all these things in our own day-to-day lives, it's about having backups. It's about all kinds of things. You're just with this recording, just with what's on your computer, your whatever it is. Backup, backup, backup. You know, because you can't trust just one thing. And the Romans understood this. They did not trust their politicians. These consuls had enormous, enormous amounts of power. The consuls, when at war, when Rome went to war, the consuls would actually lead the military forces into battle. That's why our president, if you wonder, you know, why is our president the commander-in-chief? A lot of our presidents never served in the military, have no experience. The Roman consuls, upon which the presidency is based, they were the commanders-in-chief. So our president is also the commander-in-chief. And when that consul went to war, he had this power. So much power. Part of it is the Imperium. The Imperium is the power of life and death. And what happens is, that's where we get the word empire from. And the person who has the Imperium is known as the Imperator. That's where we get the word emperor. So here, from this power of the Imperium, you get empire, emperor, all this kind of thing. Now, to give you an example of that, if a Roman unit didn't fight up to standards, if they showed cowardice, if they were incompetent, whatever it is, which would be a rare thing, very rare thing, the consul could have them all wiped out. The consul could have them decimated. What on earth does that mean? Now, today, when you say you decimated them or something, it means you annihilated them, you wiped them out completely, but that wasn't the original meaning, and if you look at it, deci is the prefix for 10. So what does decimate really mean? Decimate means kill one out of every 10. So a legion, which is the Roman formation, had about 5,000 men in it. Each legion had about 5,000 men. There was this one case. There's more than one, but this one, for example. The commander, the consul, felt that the unit didn't fight well enough. So he ordered the unit decimated. They all draw lots, and one out of every 10 who get the metaphorical short straw, who get the wrong pick, they get stoned to death. Wiping out 10% of the unit to teach them a lesson. And it's random, right? So isn't that unfair? You're not getting the people who really did it. The Romans don't care who did it. Everybody is responsible for the failure. But just to show you that nobody really gets off scot-free, who was doing the stoning of this 10%? The other 90% of the unit. I've heard it said many, many, many times when men who go to war together become closer than brothers, a special bond that can't be equivalent to anything else they've ever experienced. Still, when Rome ordered something, you did it. No questions asked. These people are closer than brothers to you, but Rome orders decimation. You pick up the stones and stone your brothers to death. That's it. What about the enemy? The same thing. Could do anything. The Romans could do absolute, the consuls had the absolute power. Julius Caesar. He went into Gaul, which again is modern day France, went into Gaul to conquer it. Gaul was made up of thousands of tribes, individual tribes. And so he's conquering them one at a time, maybe two or three at a time, that kind of thing. One of the villages, they made a peace treaty. Okay, Rome agreed and they moved on. See, Rome was very practical in that way. If you agreed, if you said, we surrender, we give up, Rome would end it right there. And they would even give you a path to become an ally and eventually become part of Rome. In a few decades. That's great. However, if you didn't fight fairly, Rome would make you pay. And this village, which had surrendered, and Julius Caesar moved on, they rose up in rebellion. You're not allowed to do that. You're not supposed to do that. You said you gave up. If you wanted to keep fighting, you could have kept fighting. But here you gave up. We accepted your surrender. And then when we left, you rose up again. Rome came back, Julius Caesar, that is, came back, put down the rebellion. What did he do to punish that village? What did he do? Some of you are thinking kill them or whatever it is. Well, the thing is, firstly, this is part of the argument against the modern death penalty. They say that these people are used to death on a day-to-day basis. It's not going to scare them. It's not going to scare them much. So, that wouldn't be so good. And also, there's this saying, out of sight, out of mind. Okay, you kill all these people, you make a big impression, but then what happens later on? People tend to forget. People say, oh yeah, this thing happened a while back, and whatever it is, and what does that have to do with us now? The Romans understood power. Julius Caesar, with the power of the Imperium, he ordered both hands cut off of every male in the village, from the eldest to the newborn babies, chop both their hands off. Now, even today, it would be hard to live like that. But back then, imagine the difficulty not only for those men, but also for the women who had to take care of them. And this is not like, oh, they died and, you know, yeah, there's a story, the people will forget about it. These are actual live people who will be there for years and decades. And the people will know and be able to even see, oh, this is how Rome punishes defiance. This is how Rome punishes disobedience. There will be no doubt in anybody's mind. So, consuls have a tremendous, tremendous amount of power. Now, there are two consuls, and just like all the other offices, there's always an even number. There's always a balance. Almost always. There's one exception, which I'll tell you in a moment. But first, this next test term. Collegiality. Collegiality. C-O-L-L-E-G-I-A-L-I-T-Y. C-O-L-L-E-G-I-A-L-I-T-Y. Collegiality. For that, you need to write. Principal. Where all major offices were held by at least two people, comma. Principal, where all major offices were held by at least two people, comma. And always an even number, period. And always an even number, period. All members of a college were of equal rank and could veto acts of other members. Period. Higher magistrates could veto acts of lower magistrates. Period. Now, what's all this? Fairly long explanation, everything like that. Collegiality, so all these offices, at least two people, an even number, because you don't want two will gang up on one, or three will gang up on two, or four will gang up on one. They want a balance. Because they want, and this is the thing to understand about yet another thing it explains about our country and our government. It is a system basically designed for gridlock. It is not a system made to get things done quickly. It is a system made to avoid a reckless or careless decision. Lots of speed bumps, lots of ways to stop something from going forward. Because the Romans, they have a very conservative way of doing things. They don't want to go off and make some crazy decision which could undermine all of society. They would rather things just don't happen. However, okay, you've got this idea of collegiality. And by the way, you see that that's also connected to the word college, where everybody is equal. College is where everybody comes together for a common purpose and everybody is equal. Later on, we'll talk about the Electoral College and you'll see the connection again. But here they want this balance and they want everything fair. And different parts could veto acts of other parts. So here you see our presidency, where the president is able to veto acts of Congress and things like that. And then Congress is able to override the president's veto. We'll probably get into that as well. Now, the Romans also understood, because they're smart, they understand sometimes you need decisions made quickly. You cannot afford gridlock. You cannot have decision making on and on and discussion and this and that. You need things done. And it, when there's an emergency, for example. Therefore, they had one office. This is the exception I told you about earlier. One office only where these things of checks and balances and veto and everything like that did not apply. And it is a test term. Dictator. This is a test term. Dictator. D-I-C-T-A-T-O-R. D-I-C-T-A-T-O-R. Dictator. For that you need to write, originally meant, quote, one who gives orders, close quote. Originally meant, quote, one who gives orders, close quote. And had no negative connotation, period. And had no negative connotation, period. Then continue writing, appointed and given total power by consuls, C-O-N-S-U-L-S, by consuls, during times of emergency, for the length of the emergency, comma, but maximum 6 months, period. But maximum 6 months, period. Okay. Now, what is that? I think you guys understand when there's a crisis, when there's an invasion or something like that, we need decisions made quickly. They have this office. A dictator, there's only one of them. This is the only office where the principle of collegiality does not apply. They cannot be vetoed. They say what to do, people do it. They dictate, they don't discuss. That's not the title of their position. Now, they have absolute power only, though, for the length of the emergency or for 6 months, whichever is shorter. That means if the emergency lasts 5 months, how long are they dictator? 5 months. If the emergency lasts 7 months, how long are they dictator? 6 months. That's it. They'll have to get someone else to be dictator again for the next month because they want a strict limitation, especially when it comes to this absolute power. They're concerned it's going to go to people's heads. People are going to try and make themselves a king. There you go. Now, so the Roman Republic lasted about 500 years. 500 years is a long time. That's about twice as long as our country has existed. So obviously it had a lot to recommend it. It had many, many benefits to it, but it had a deficiency, which we will talk about soon. I did say I would break this lecture up into two, so we'll only go for maybe 10 more minutes, and then I'll hit stop, and then the next part, part B, will be attached to this one. But here, you see the Roman Republic went for about 500 years, but this problem here, it is designed basically for gridlock. It's designed to be easily stopped if everyone doesn't agree. And just like our country, there are all kinds of things that go on, filibustering and things like that. Even a small group is able to stop a huge action by a huge amount of politicians. It's designed that way. Our system is designed like that. And Rome got more and more and more problems that became unmanageable until finally the Republic had kind of broken down. It wasn't working anymore. And that's when Julius Caesar stepped up and basically ended the Republic. Now, from that point on, Rome was basically an empire. Rome was an empire. And it lasted maybe another 500 years. But eventually the German barbarians were able to take down the Roman Empire. The Western Roman Empire. The Eastern Roman Empire still survived. It became known later on as the Byzantine Empire. So the Western Roman Empire has fallen apart. That's it. German barbarians are in charge of all this territory. And they are led by kings. These German tribes have kings. Now, when they take over these huge, huge areas, they subdivide it and subdivide it and subdivide it until it becomes manageable. Okay, they're able to manage it. But they still have a king, so it's now a monarchy again. We've kind of come full circle. Remember I told you with Cro-Magnons and the chieftain and everything like that? So monarchy, then it changed to aristocracy, then timocracy, then all these other things. But now these German kings have taken over the large chunks of Europe. That's fine. We're back to monarchy. However, this is kind of a key. It is no longer what is called a consultative monarchy, where the monarch does not have absolute power, even with the Cro-Magnons. You'll have one person in charge, but that person is going to talk to the other people and get their consent. The best warriors, the eldest members of the tribe, basically to at least hear them out and also to give them some say in what decisions are going to be made. That's not what's going on now. Europe, right around 500 AD, the Roman Empire has fallen, the German kings have taken over, and their monarchy, which is, again, it's a monarchy, is becoming more and more divine right. Divine right monarchy. And what that is, as you might imagine, the ruler, the king, has been chosen by God, or gods, or whatever it is, as the Romans would have. And therefore, the leader knows what is best. End of story. The leader is not to be questioned or argued with. End of story. This was taken absolutely seriously, and it got worse and worse as time went on. You have a couple of examples I can think of. I mean, one of them, this French king was riding in the forest. And just like today, as I say, times change, but people don't. He has his group with him, his posse, his entourage that are following around, and he's being watched and everything like that. And just like today, where people drive this blinged out car with nice rims and everything like that, the French king, he had not only a really powerful horse, he had a nice silver saddle with a silver horn sticking out the front. And the thing is, when they were riding, something spooked his horse so badly that it bucked really, really wild, and this leather strap that's supposed to hold the king in his seat, kind of like a seat belt, it broke. And so the king bounced up, and as he was coming down, that horn part, which is right in front of him on the saddle, actually went all the way through his groin and into his stomach. His men must have been horrified, absolutely horrified. They cut him down, cut up the saddle. They would have liked to pull the saddle out of him because the horn is still stuck in there, but it's a horn. It works like a hook. If you pull the saddle out, it'll disembowel him and pull his guts out with it. Now, this French king was probably begging, "Oh, please kill me, put me out of my misery." They did not do that. I think it took him, if I recall, it took him days to die. why didn't they do it? Like, this king, he's probably ordering them, kill him. Why don't they do it? Because it is sacrilege to spill the blood of a king. Divine right monarchy, that's what it is. Taken very, very seriously. Another example, King Richard the Lionheart. King Richard the Lionheart. Now, he wasn't a very good king, but he was good at fighting. His men liked him, everything like that, but he wasn't a very good king. Goes off to fight in the Crusades, gets captured. Has to be ransomed back, to be returned back home. But when he gets back home, he realizes a lot of people have risen up in rebellion while he was kidnapped. And he has to go around reconquering all these territories that rebelled. And he's the same kind of guy. He doesn't get that nickname, the Lionheart, for nothing. King Richard the Lionheart. What happens is he's always leading from the front, saying, "Oh, follow me, men. You have nothing to be afraid of." This one castle, which he's in front of, he's marching back and forth in front of the castle. "Are you afraid of this? You have nothing to fear." And that's fine. But he actually does get shot by an arrow. It's a lucky shot, but still, he gets shot basically in the shoulder. Now, his men, horrified by this, they rush up, grab his body, and pull him back further away from this castle, which they're about to storm. Now, they do storm the castle, and they do take the castle. That's fine. The king, now, the doctor did try and remove the arrow, but he screwed it up and mangled it, and the king got gangrene. But they've taken the castle. King Richard the Lionheart's people have taken the castle. Richard says, "You know, I would like to meet the man who fired that arrow. Tell him to come forward. I give you my word, no harm will come to him." And, you know, they've taken the whole castle. It's only a matter of time before they find out. So the person comes forward. It's basically a 15-year-old boy, a cook. And Richard the Lionheart says, "Oh, you know, the kid's probably terrified, sweating bullets." Goes to see the king. The king says, "Oh, you know, you needn't be afraid of me. You know, I don't mind that you did this. You should be commended for this. You killed a king. In fact, you didn't just kill any king. You killed King Richard the Lionheart." And he actually gives this kid a small bag of silver coins. "Here you are. You earned it." Now, this kid is probably thinking, "My God, there aren't many men in the world like that." Well, the king passes away. Kid gets up to leave. And his men, King Richard the Lionheart's men, are blocking the exit. They're saying, "Any deal you had with him died with him. You're not going anywhere with that silver. In fact, you're not going anywhere, period." They take the silver from him, and if you know what a war charger is, it's a really powerful horse, able to gallop a fully grown man and all equipment and everything into battle. So it's a really strong horse. They tie one to each of his limbs, one to each arm and one to each leg, so four horses, and then whip them in a gallop to rip him apart. That's what it is. Now, that is slightly disputed. Some people say, no, that's not what happened. Instead, he was burned at the stake. So not much better in my book, but just so you know, that's the situation. But just so you understand, come near the end of the Middle Ages, basically all of Europe is divine right monarchy. That's how it is. Forget about democracy and everything like that. All of Europe has become divine right monarchy. And again, we cover a lot of time right now. We're right around we're in the 1600s now, AD. By the way, if someone doesn't say BC or BCE or something like that, you assume it's AD or CE. You don't need to say AD. Like if somebody asks you what year it is now, you just say it's the year 2020. You don't say 2020 AD. So we're in this. So far, we've caught up to the 1600s right now, covered gigantic amounts of time, and you will see there is going to be an extreme reaction to this divine right monarchy. Someone will come along, his name is John Locke, if you've ever heard that name before, and that's where we'll pick up this next lecture, or a little bit before then.